Okay, welcome all to Marxism. I hope you enjoy yourselves for the weekend, and I hope this is a good start to the weekend as well for you. So the movement of Tiananmen Square 1989 was one that shook the world, and for several weeks, millions of ordinary Chinese people took to the streets of their cities and towns to demand basic democratic freedoms. And for millions of people around the world, Tiananmen Square was a momentous illustration of both the power of students and workers, but also the lengths to which the ruling elite will go to save their system. And the recent events that we've seen sweeping across the Middle East remind us of this very power. We've seen dictatorships toppled, workers occupying their workplaces, students and the poor sacrificing their lives for democracy. And from Tiananmen Square 1989 to the Egyptian Revolution and Tahrir Square of 2011, time and time again we are shown the power of ordinary people and their capacity to fight for a better world. And I would argue that learning the lessons from this movement is even more vital to the project of changing the world today. The Chinese working class now totals just over 700 million people, and the Chinese state is central to global capitalist competition. In order to mount a serious challenge to capitalism, we must acknowledge the powerful history of the movement of Tiananmen Square. Firstly, though, the political importance of Tiananmen cannot be understated, especially for those of us who are committed to a program of genuine revolutionary socialism. We in Socialist Alternative do not think that China has ever bared any resemblance to revolutionary socialism. China is a capitalist state, a state divided by class. The state bureaucracy in China dictates the direction of the economy and investment, and just like any other capitalist state, it's committed to remaining competitive on the world capitalist stage. In that sense, the democracy movements of the 1980s and the intensifying labour unrest that we're seeing today are all the more important in demonstrating to the world that these brutal one-party dictatorships have nothing to do with genuine socialism. Secondly, in order to come to grips with the movement of 89, we must acknowledge the rich history of resistance in China. So, contrary to the racist perceptions of the West, the Chinese working class has fought many heroic battles for socialism and justice. The Chinese Revolution of the 1920s laid a firm basis for working class organisation. And from the Cultural Revolution through to the student rebellions of the 60s and 70s, China was a hub of political activism and underground radical politics. In particular, in the decade in the immediate lead up to 89 was where we saw students take centre stage. So as 89 approached, the Chinese ruling class was faced with a perfect storm, if you like. An overheated economy, runaway food prices, rampant corruption and thwarted expectations. Deng Xiaoping, the then de facto leader of the Communist Party, was well underway in implementing his pro-market strategies, which had since the late 70s opened up China to foreign investment and trade. And Deng's strategies were met with contradictory reactions from within the party, often leading to a flip-flopping of strategy from over-centralisation and control to a rapid loosening of economic and political restrictions. And this was, an important factor in capturing the mood of the Chinese people at the time, and in particular the students. So on the one hand, their lives had been opened up to a whole new period of cultural and educational experiences, but on the other, the party still ruled with an iron fist, and freedom of expression was severely limited. So the students in China represented a unique layer within society, often from a more privileged section. Many were increasingly frustrated with the lack of choice, freedom and control over their own lives. And more of them were graduating only to face the prospect of either unemployment or a stagnant job in the state bureaucracy. And as one author puts it, this generation was too young to remember the Cultural Revolution. They had not come to adulthood with a vision of Deng Xiaoping as the man who would put China back on track. Instead, they had spent their adolescence exposed to the consequences of his reforms. And these were the kinds of sentiments that really fueled the revolt of 1989. So like many revolutions, the revolution of Tiananmen Square was set off by a seemingly tiny spark. On April 15th, Hu Yaobang died. Now, Hu was a senior member of the Communist Party, and he was somewhat revered by the students and intellectuals because he was removed from his post in 87 because of his sympathetic position towards the democratic student movements at the time. And initially, Hu was very much the focus of the demonstrations. Large, defiant funeral marches filled Tiananmen Square. But very rapidly, eulogies transformed into speeches about democracy, freedom of press, and an end to corruption. Political posters were plastered on the streets. Initially confined to university notice boards, they soon spread throughout the city and reappeared on the democracy wall. And some of you will have been lucky to get one of my handouts that I didn't photocopy enough of. But if you look at the image there, there's actually a democracy wall which was used in the previous movements. And you can see everyone sort of milling around. It's where you basically posted anything you wanted to be heard, read, seen on there. So poems, political programs and artwork, a real flourishing of expression and determination. And the ruling party was quick to ban the protests and gatherings in the square. Yet hundreds of thousands of people came out to march on the day of Hu's funeral. And as the truck driver told The Observer, which is a Chinese paper, when the students sang the Internationale, which is the universal anthem for socialism and workers' rights, there was a sense that they were reclaiming it as an anthem of rebellion. And their rebellion, their spontaneous outbursts of sorrow, was transforming rapidly into an organised movement for political reform. Significantly, student activists were already focusing on creating an independent student union in rejection of the official student unions, which are effectively arms of the state. And their union would later become known as the Autonomous Students' Federation. So over the next few days, an indefinite class boycott was called in practically every university across Beijing. From the outset, the Communist Party had positioned itself as hostile to the protests. Deng called for the quashing of the movement by, quote, bloodshed if necessary, and the state-controlled press labelled the movement as a counter-revolutionary conspiracy. And rank-and-file students were particularly angered by these responses and really amped up their activity, and within a couple of weeks, they were out on the streets agitating for support amongst workers and the broader community. So as one worker remembers, work came to a complete halt in every factory, office block and building site. Traffic ground to a standstill and onlookers climbed up trees onto rooftops and billboards to urge the protesters on. Clinging to scaffolding, construction labourers banged tin lunchboxes with chopsticks and roared their support. On at least three occasions, crowds of thousands of workers intervened to surround hundreds of army troops and prevent them from approaching student marches. So the next major round of protests was called for May 4th, and this is when the protests seriously took off around the rest of the country. So tens of thousands of students had begun organising on their campuses alongside the massive protests in the cities. So whilst the movement was growing, drawing in more and more layers of Chinese society, the role of the student leadership becomes increasingly important. And I'm just going to take a brief moment to explain some of the political dynamics of the leadership that impacted on the trajectory of the struggle, as it was in these early days of May when they faced their first real challenges. So at this point, it was evident that the leadership was struggling to maintain momentum, the momentum of the movement, focusing heavily on arranging talks with the government and gaining legal recognition of the Student Federation meant that the numbers fell away temporarily in some of the central Beijing protests. And the priority of the leadership was always to negotiate with the government, and this had proved fatal throughout the entire duration of the movement. So as their May 4th manifesto states, our views are not in conflict with those of the government. We only have one goal, the modernisation of China. Now, the leadership of Tiananmen wasn't a homogenous bloc. They had varying ideas about how to take the movement forward, but there's a few unifying features to their political thought. So, for example, most student leaders coming from the upper middle class had quite elitist ideas towards Chinese workers. They recognised that it was necessary to get them on board to sustain the movement, but they also held ideas that democracy had to be introduced slowly. That's a quote, as the people were not used to it. And such attitudes often led to anti-working class positions, and as some more reactionary leaders put it, the greatest barriers to progress are our 1 billion people and our 5,000 years of Chinese history. More than this, a key feature of the leadership was that they, I guess you could say, they were anti-political. In part, this was a rejection of the Stalinist state. You know, the fact that their fundamental grievances were with the dogmatic and dictatorial party often meant that they bent too far the other way, making them hesitant to adhere to more decisive or confrontational strategies. So as one leader states, there is no ruling theoretical framework. We just follow our feelings. It is a pure and unsullied demand for democracy. Also, and I think probably fundamentally, the leadership strategy embraced Chinese nationalism. As their manifesto states, our views are not in conflict with those of the government. And these students, they really viewed themselves as the future bright lights of a modern China. And this misguided approach meant that there wasn't a clear discussion about what attitude to take to the state. But I think more fundamentally, it meant that they accepted, you know, the status quo idea that their demands and reforms could be granted by orienting to, you know, the appropriate channels of the Chinese state. So having said this, the anger and resentment persisted unabated, as the state had effectively ignored the students' demands. And on May 13th, we see an uptick in momentum when the movement is revived by the dramatic actions of the hunger strikers. So initially, a couple of hundred students went on hunger strike within the square. And within a couple of days, this had swelled to 1,000. And throughout the course of the next few days, thousands of people started to spill into the square. And by May 17th, the numbers had reached just over 2 million people. And the days of mid-May in Beijing were really the height of the movement. It wasn't just the square that was transformed. It was the entire city. And several interesting developments occurred over these few days. As one eyewitness reflects, this was the first time that members of the People's Liberation Army, which is the Chinese army, had joined the anti-government protests. Also, police forces marched as a contingent, holding a banner, "The People's Police Love the People." And university students, students from outer provinces and cities joined as contingents, banners saying, "Shanghai and Beijing breathe together." And students from Tianjin, Hebei and Henan, to name but a few, joined the rallies. And this is really when you can get a sense of the national scale of the revolt. And this is obviously something I think that is, you know, not exactly demonstrated in the history books, that this encapsulated the whole of China. So not only were students flowing in from the countryside, they were organising and demonstrating in their own towns. 7,000 students in Shenyang, which is a northeastern industrial city. You can see there's a little map there. Basically, it was the provinces that were directly next to Beijing and up on the northern coastline that were quite active. So marched on their provincial government compound and staged a sit-in. In Changchun, another major industrial city in the northeast, students organised teach-ins, which is like a lecture, basically. At least 1,000 people attending any one teach-in. So you can get that sense that, you know, there's thousands of people wanting to discuss and debate and learn, you know. And in Xi'an, where they had suffered immense repression in the demonstrations at the end of April, tens of thousands of people marched through their cities. Demonstrations filled with schoolchildren, teachers, families, peasants and construction workers. In Changsha, a major town in south-central China, there are stories of students breaking out of their dorms as they'd been locked in by heads of department and joining the marches in their thousands, some 1,500 of them marching in their medical coats. And there's a very excited young person in their medical coat on your handout as well. it's a really good photo. The stories are similar across the country, and as one observer puts it, May 17th began what would be more than 3 weeks of sit-ins, hunger strikes, demonstrations, class boycotts and workers' strikes. Also, it was around this time when you begin to see an upturn in organised working class activity and a real presence of workers on the demonstrations. So this wasn't the first time that workers had participated in the mass demonstrations, but it was definitely a step forward to see the presence of an organised working class within the movement. And it's worth drawing out here the role of workers in Tiananmen, as it's often a contested part of its history. So as I said earlier, elements of the student leadership held quite elitist views about the working class, which would prove to be a serious barrier to working class involvement throughout the duration of the movement. I think it's captured well in this quote taken from Cries for Democracy, which is a book that documents every poster, leaflet, letter, like scrap of paper found on the side of the street. There's everything in there. It's quite amazing, actually. Beijing students enthusiastically welcomed the support of Chinese from other segments of society. Yet there was also an ambivalence in their ranks about close association with non-student organisations, particularly workers' groups. Some prominent student figures believed in the purity of the student movement, maintaining order and control over protest activities. Students feared that workers were less disciplined and more prone to violence. Also, the fact that up until the last days of martial law, the workers' base camp was stationed under the West Reviewing Stand of Tiananmen Square, which is distinctively separated out from the central student base. And examples of student leaders actually prohibiting working class unionists from reading their documents over the central loudspeakers were recorded as late as May 20th. All evidence, I think, of the elitist politics and student leadership. So initially in the movement, workers were more involved on an individual level. And as the editor of Cries for Democracy puts it, who is an anonymous Chinese activist of the time. In any event, even after their formal establishment, worker organisations remained rather amorphous, loose-knit groups composed of a limited number of activist workers rather than tight organisations with a broad worker base. As Han Dongfeng remembers, Han was the key labour leader of their union. As Han remembers, workers themselves did form their own independent union, but only a few weeks before the crackdown. The union, named the Beijing Autonomous Workers' Federation, the BWAF, was to remain tiny when considering the actual number of workers involved in the movement. So it's impossible to know the exact figures, but activist biographies put it at around 150 active members in the square at any one time. And an interview with two of the trade unionists who were actually responsible for the registration of new members said that by June 3rd, which is the day of the crackdown, by June 3rd they had membership lists of 20,000. However, she obviously burned all of these lists as they were fleeing the square. So fundamentally, though, one of the tragedies of the BWAF's involvement within the movement was that they failed to develop organised branches within any of the key workplaces of Beijing. Having said this, though, some of the more militant sections of the working class, namely the capital workers who were in one of the core capital iron, ore and steel works, had developed their own union with the eye of organising across the city. So contrary to the student movement, the number of workers involved in Tiananmen increased dramatically after the declaration of martial law. And the activity of the BWAF escalated as well. So by the end of May, they had a printing press and they were holding public recruitment drives within the square, and they developed a specific program. Noting that the BWAF's objectives are to fight for democracy, bring down dictatorship, support and protect the student hunger strikers, and promote democratisation in alliance with the students and citizens. So although the union activists were heavily involved and more often than not actually spearheaded some of the more militant actions, such as the workers' pickets corps, which was set up to protect the students within the square, or the Dare to Die Brigades, it's a pretty tough name, I reckon, which were created to block and organise against plainclothes police that were infiltrating the square. The fundamental weakness would remain unchanged in that they would fail to make significant inroads in the factories in any real organised sense. So in essence, there was serious working class participation within the movement of Tiananmen, but the form that this took was rather disparate and unorganised in that the official union wasn't formed until much later within the movement. This obviously impacted on the degree to which an organised working class current could establish itself within the struggle. But fundamentally, we need to acknowledge the significant role that workers played within the movement as it highlights the breadth and depth of Tiananmen. So by May 17th and 18th, we're really getting to the peak of the movement. To give people a sense of this, there were over 3,000 hunger strikers occupying the square. And so when one hunger striker fainted and was carted out to hospital, another volunteered to replace them. And surrounding them in concentric circles, that's how it was organised in the square. You had circle, 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 and you had little passageways that you could sort of filter into whichever layer you wanted to go to. And so surrounding them were thousands of students, so lectures, discussions and organising meetings constantly taking place. And within the square itself, there was an estimated 2 million people. Now, this is Tiananmen Square, the largest square in the world. So for those of you who are interested, I did some research on the actual size of it. It's 440,000 square metres. So comparing this to Tahrir Square of Cairo, which is the centre of the Egyptian Revolution, that is 47,000 square metres. So Tiananmen Square is almost 10 times the size of this. So full of people that the buses, the public transport had to stop tens of kilometres outside of the city so people could walk in because it's so crammed, the streets are so crammed. And I want to read at length a really beautiful quote from one of the posters in central Beijing, the author writing about the Chinese students and workers. "They have moved the world with their indomitable revolutionary spirit, one of absolute selflessness in the face of all kinds of danger as they fight for justice, a spirit that they have never been able to express under normal circumstances. The army's trucks and tanks have been kept in the suburbs by public buses and garbage cans used as roadblocks, and by people who are willing to let their bodies, bodies of flesh and blood, be crushed by the tanks. And the soldiers are being persuaded by excited people and students, and quite a number of soldiers have driven their trucks away. The workers are on strike and the people are in the streets. Traffic is being directed not by policemen, but by students and city residents. The streets are filled with passers-by, leaflets and knots of people continually forming and reforming. People are exchanging news, discussing the development of events and expressing their opinions. On the ruins of the autocratic system, we will rebuild a great China. And beyond the capital, the towns and cities of China were really alight. Hunger strikes had broken out in Shanghai and 30,000 students were occupying the city centre. 100,000 people marched in Nanjing and Guiyang and tens of thousands marched in the capital of Inner Mongolia. And in some provinces such as Zhejiang, thousands of people stormed government offices and in Tibet, hundreds of students were occupying their central university. And of course, thousands of these students were streaming into Beijing on trains provided for free by striking railway workers. Having witnessed the unfolding escalation of the movement, the Communist Party was forced to make a bit of an appearance. So up until now, the government had barely moved in response to the mass movements. And as one historian remarks, it was either because they realised that doing nothing was their best move, or more probably because they were split on how to react. Regardless, on May 18th, Li Peng, who represented the real kind of hardline conservatives and was quite high up in the government, Li Peng and a handful of government officials met with the student leadership. I'm attached to the call. How interesting. Okay, I'm unattached. Predictably, the meeting was a farce. Li Peng refused to enter into a genuine dialogue with the students, and the students themselves, they put forward their demands. Firstly, we think Zhao or Li Peng had better go to Tiananmen and talk directly to the students there. Secondly, the People's Daily should acknowledge the significance of the current student movement. As for the dialogue, it should be open, equal, direct and sincere. So the official transcript was published in the Beijing Review, which is a Chinese paper, which is really a win in of itself that the press was actually forced to publish the truth. The state press, I should say. And as for the students of Tiananmen, they got a pathetic display of grasping at straws from the regime. So when Zhao was sort of a favoured Communist Party leader of the time, when Zhao visited the students, he actually cried. He came into the square and he's surrounded by all these students and he broke down in tears, claiming that they were busy and that they were sorry that they hadn't come earlier. And that they were really, I know, it's really shameful actually. They were really, you know, fearful for the students' lives who were on hunger strike, tears, you know, all that stuff. And I think the reality was becoming pretty clear for them. The Chinese government was now faced with a mass movement far beyond something that could be placated by a few demands being met. And as one eyewitness journalist puts it, the move from student uprising to a workers' uprising is what really scared the Chinese government. They felt they could deal with the students. Where it became dangerous to the stability and to the survival of the Communist Party was when ordinary workers became involved. And I believe it was these kinds of sentiments that led to the declaration of martial law and the sending in of 300,000 troops to regain control over Beijing. So as soon as the news of the troops spread, students and workers rushed to the outskirts of the city to try and stop the troops from entering. Workers set up all-night barricades to defend their streets. Tank tyres were let down, petrol was drained from their engines, and the power was cut to the train lines, and buses were physically dragged across the intersections and set on fire. And there were widespread calls for strike action that weekend, which saw tens of thousands of workers out. And here, the role of the People's Liberation Army was crucial. So when the troops were initially sent in, when martial law was declared, they literally could not get into the city. And there's a few photos on the handout as well of the trucks actually being like swamped by thousands of people. So they were either swamped by the protesters or they were persuaded to retreat. Young soldiers, 18, 19 years old, being spoken to by protesters, argued with about why they shouldn't come into the city, being given food and drinks, you know, a real sense of confidence on behalf of the protesters. And as one young woman states so clearly when arguing with a soldier, "As one who is a relative of yours, I beg you with my tears, do not under any circumstances touch our students, and do not under any circumstances anger the people. I am standing in front of you with my son in my arms. If you decide to advance, you will have to drive your tanks over my body." And I think the fact that the demonstrators managed to convince 300,000 troops not to shoot or enter Beijing was a real victory and a real indication of the movement's strength. And it was obviously an incredible embarrassment and shock to the ruling class, and perhaps goes partway in explaining their unprecedented crackdown. So in these last few days, there was a renewed flurry of debate about the way forward. By now, most of the student leaders were keen on ending the hunger strikes. However, some sections were looking to escalate the struggle. For example, in one of the student leaders' biographies, it was reported that on the 23rd of May, there was a formal meeting called of all organisations involved to discuss a united way forward for the movement. Also, in terms of working class action, a general strike was called by the BWAF. Tragically, this was opposed by some sections of the student leadership as it jeopardised, quote, the national interest, and was called off. And movement within the army was also concerning the establishment. So by now, hundreds of Beijing rank and file soldiers were defecting every day. And as Charlie Hall puts it in his book, The Road to Tiananmen, that weekend, the revolt turned into revolution. Workers and students were in control of the whole of Beijing, and the government seemed helpless. It had assumed that the declaration of martial law and the sight of troops would be enough to frighten the movement into submission. Instead, it had risen to even greater heights. However, revolutions cannot stand still, and I think these few days in China are really illustrative of that fact. The movement was escalating to such a point now that workers and students had effectively taken over Beijing. They had the confidence and capacity to take control of their own lives. Furthermore, the regime was crippled, losing more and more credibility day by day. And even the leaders that seemed to be part of the solution in the beginning now seemed irrelevant at best. However, in order for the movement to go forward, there needed to be conscious intervention of the organised working class. The movement needed to harness the massive power of Chinese workers, call a general strike, stop work in the huge industrial ports, halt the unloading of ships at the docks, strike in the massive auto factories. These were the things that were needed to topple the Chinese rulers. And these were the things that were needed to propel the revolution forward. However, the political repercussions of the student leadership strategy meant that this was never on the cards. To recognise the need for organised working class involvement would mean breaking with the strategy of orienting to the Chinese state and fundamentally breaking with the idea that the state could grant them their reforms. And ultimately, it was in these moments that the ruling party unleashed the full force of their state. The gravity of the crackdown is pretty unimaginable. On the evening of June 3rd, thousands of troops were brought in from the countryside. They were actually brought in from outside of Beijing, obviously because the Beijing army had now developed a real sense of solidarity with the protesters. So they were moved into Beijing. It took the troops several hours to actually enter the square as they confronted consistent street fighting and resistance. Every time a blockade was broken, another was set up. And the death toll is still unknown, but the Chinese Red Cross puts it at 2,600, with the worst fighting and the highest death toll in the outer suburbs of the city. Eyewitnesses reported troops machine gunning whole apartment buildings and shooting demonstrators in the back as they ran. When troops reached the square, they shut off all the lights, allowing the tanks to roll in, killing unknown numbers. And by the end of 89, more than 30,000 people had been arrested, many of whom were shot in secret. In some provinces and towns, such as Jinan, people were publicly executed. Workers involved received the harshest of convictions, many locked away for years without proper trial, and some were executed by secret police, and many activists today are still in exile, unable to return. Importantly, there was heroic resistance to the repression. Student activists and trade unions were hidden in solidarity and smuggled out in the dead of night. And there was continuous street fighting. And on June 4th, some demonstrators actually attempted to re-enter the square, holding hands and confronting lines of tanks. But ultimately, on that day, the state managed to push back the mighty movement of Tiananmen and brutally reassert its power. So the lessons from Tiananmen teach us several important points that mustn't be forgotten. The bravery and determination of people involved shows us the strength and capacity of ordinary people to change the world. Having said this, the limits of Tiananmen demonstrate the importance of class politics. Throughout history, students have demonstrated their capacity to engage in radical action. Students as a transitory and volatile layer within society can often play a crucial role in galvanising the population, inspiring people and pushing the struggle to radical new heights. But student struggle cannot replace that of workers. As socialists, we recognise in order to see genuine human liberation, the unjust system of capitalism must be overthrown. And only the collective, economic and political struggle of the international working class can achieve this. Students and workers can and have fought alongside each other in many momentous social movements. But in order for the revolution to be triumphant, the working class must lead that struggle. And so I want to leave everyone today with an article that I found when I was researching for this talk. This article went viral as soon as it hit the internet, and it was entitled "Tiananmen-like Courage in Cairo." Yeah. And it was a film clip of thousands of people marching through the streets of Cairo of the Egyptian Revolution of January this year. And the protest, of course, was being stalked by the regime's tanks and water cannons and military. And one protester had actually turned around to face the water tank that was coming towards the protest. And he walked right up to this water tank and climbed on top of this water tank and put his body like right in front of it. And he, if anyone's seen the footage, I don't know, but the tank sort of tries to, like, get around and, and look a bit ridiculous. And anyway, so this protest has climbed up here and dozens of other people see what this person's doing and they rush to support him and they manage to actually pull the driver out and do with him what they will. And they stop this tank from coming forward. And I think, anyway, the point here is that this kind of courage and determination and real outpouring of human capacity is associated with the uprising of Tiananmen Square. You know, 20-odd years later, Tiananmen is the word that comes to people's mind to explain these kinds of acts. And we all know here that just as the Egyptian Revolution was far deeper and more wonderful than that one individual act, so too was Tiananmen. This image is a mere expression of the totally transformed spirit and humanity that gripped the people of China. And it is this kind of spirit that necessarily lies at the heart of a movement fit to overthrow capitalism. And I would say to the Chinese students and workers of today that you only have to look a few pages back in your history to see your strength, to know your capacity and your potential. And that we have all learnt so much from your struggle. And we all wait with bated breath until that Tiananmen-like courage sweeps across China once again. Thank you.